Hello and welcome to Football Memories and Moments. Basically, we've interviewed people who all share one thing, a love of football. In this podcast, we find out their favourite memory, something personal to them, and a moment that stands out forever. We hope you enjoy, and if you do, please like, subscribe and rate.
We are joined this week by David Priest. David's a former professional goalkeeper. Started his career at Sunderland, he's played for Aberdeen in Scotland, and he's also played out in Denmark as well. And it was great to chat to David, an absolute bear of a man. We met in London, and he talked about his memory was about actually something that could have potentially been upsetting for a few people, I think. But not like war upsetting, but it was his last ever game for the club that he loved so much. He still writes a column for the local paper up in Sunderland, and he talked about how his last game came about, and the fact that it's still such a strong memory for him, probably a better term actually, was really fascinating to hear. And then his moment was good. It's not a specific standout football moment, it's not a specific moment within a game, but it is a moment that means so much to him, and hopefully as you go on to see, it'll be quite clear how generations past had their love of the game instilled in them. Anyway, on with the podcast. I hope you enjoy.
So you've gone for your last game for Sunderland. So what year was this?
This was 1997 in the May. Sunderland just been relegated from the Premier League. It was Pete Reid's first season in the Premier League, and we lost to Wimbledon on the Saturday. So the place was pretty down. And they'd had this game organised against Liverpool. It was kind of to celebrate Roker Park. The next season, the club were going to be moving to the Stadium of Light, and so it was. Nobody really knew how it was going to go. But like I said, because it had been a tough end of the season, we'd had a lot of hope that we were going to stay up, and obviously going to Selhurst Park last day of the season when Wimbledon were playing there. It was a huge disappointment. So I think it must be the Tuesday night of the next week. The season's over. There's everyone's feeling really down. Half the players aren't in for the training session the day before the game because, basically the season's over and nobody really wanting to play the game. We had Liverpool coming who they were bringing a full side. They promised to bring a full side out there and we basically didn't know whether there was going to be anybody there at all, so it was a real strange atmosphere in training because it was basically just all kids and a couple of first teamers, and all I was really worried about was, because Roker Park was being knocked down, all I was worried about was what I could take from the ground to keep myself. So it's kind of I ended up taking the two things I really wanted was the peg that I'd used for best part of 6 years, well, getting changed every year, which I took that down. And the other bit, I desperately, desperately wanted a couple of bricks from outside of the main entrance, the players' entrance at Roker Park, because from my youth team playing days there, there was a bit of graffiti scrawled about, I don't know, 10 foot up the wall, saying David Priest is lush. So I wanted to, when they were knocking that down, I wanted it sort of like, almost like a mini Banksy.
Yeah.
Obviously,
did you write that yourself?
Do you know what? No, I didn't. But I think it was because it was so high and the walls never got painted. They weren't even bothered about it. So it stood up there for like five or six years. So every time, even if I was feeling down, I spent best part of two seasons injured, the last two seasons I was there. So even though it was a tough time and ended up being miserable for most of it, every time I walked in the train the next morning, it was... put a smile on my face. Anyway.
Where is it now? Do you still have the did you get the brick?
No, I didn't. No, they just it's a housing estate now.
Oh, and, no.
So they knocked that down pretty quickly, But it was so it was, and for me, I already knew that I was leaving the club.
Right.
So I'd already had the meeting with Peter Reid where he'd explained I'd been in Europe for the best part of 2 years. Brought me on twice in the same place, and it was. That second season after I'd had an operation on it, it was kind of, I'd had a steel plate and a metal pin, titanium pin put in my wrist. So I'd missed about 3 months because of that. And then when I got back for the best part of 6 months, it was almost felt like it didn't feel like my hand. It was just totally numb. Every time I played, I'd put like, I strapped it up so it was like a plaster cast, basically. So I was catching the ball. It was, I mean, pretty much most of my career it was a toss up whether I would catch it or not. But particularly at that time, it was kind of difficult for us, like, you know, and my confidence took a hit. So it was, and then the final hit came from Peter Reid, say that even though you're in my contract, I will, you know, looking to move me on, like, you know,
yeah.
And kind of trying to convince me that would be the best option for me to go. And in the end, it was right.
Yeah.
I end up sort of before the end of that season, I'd agreed a deal to go to Darlington, sign with James Hodgson at Darlington.
Yeah.
And then, it was all done and dusted. I knew where I was going the next season. It was, and when it came to the game, I was devastated because I thought I would actually start the game.
Yeah.
I think Lionel Perez had went straight back to France, and there was myself and Chris Woods, who'd been signed on a short term deal sort of just before transfer deadline, sort of to, because I'd been on bench most of that year.
Yeah.
And then he brought Chris Woods in just because he felt he needed, you know, if something happened to Lionel Perez, that he needed somebody experienced to come in. So it was myself and Chris Woods.
How old were you at this time?
I was 21 at the time. And I said I'd spent a few seasons sort of spent a lot of time on the bench playing reserve team football, and there was a couple of times, twice, when I thought I was going to get a debut. First time when I first brought me on, sort of like 3 days before, I thought I was going to get my debut for the side. Just a pretty innocuous thing, just practicing free kicks on a Tuesday afternoon, and Lee Howie, Steve Howie's brother, I'd made a save from a free kick, and I just dived straight back on top of the ball, and he went for the same time, and sort of stood on my arm, and exactly. So it was, the worst thing about it was that I went for scans and x-rays, and it didn't show up for about 5 weeks, so I'd have a couple of days off and rest it, the scans would come back, and then nothing would happen anyway. So then I'd go back to training, and it wasn't too bad. I trained for a couple of days, then it got bad again.
Yeah.
And then eventually found out it was broken, like, you know. So it was, so that's how that happened. So I missed making my debut then. So it was a huge setback. And then this final game would have been, it was perfect for me to, you know, like the final send off. And in the end, I got Peter Reid sort of brought me in for the last 25 minutes.
So those 25 minutes you've come on, and what was the crowd? That I vaguely remember a game, and was it well attended? Was it
full house?
Like
I said, we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know how many people were going to show up, what the mood of the place would be, and obviously it really didn't matter. It wasn't about that season. It was about people saying goodbye to a part of their childhoods. The people had been going there for God knows how many years, like, you know, and they want to say goodbye to it as well. So it wasn't really about that season.
Yeah.
So we kind of underestimated how much it meant to everyone. And
when you were on the bench and you're watching the game, there's 100,000 emotions going through your mind. But can you try and isolate them as the fan when you're on the bench, as the Sunderland fan growing up, and then as the professional player, is kind of not going to have that anymore?
Most of the time, there was no difference. I mean, at that time, even when I was like 16, 17 in the youth team and going to reserves, behind the Roker end, which is the end without a roof, it was just a stand without a roof, behind that stand there was kind of like, there was a couple of walls where there was goals painted on the walls. And even then, even though I was playing for Sunderland, I would go down there and sort of like just practice striking a ball or whatever it was, and just messing about.
Did you grow up close to Roker, or
Well, I mean, it's just the other side of the river, and it was that was always the dream. I didn't want that as a kid. I was at Man United School of Excellence, which they had in the Northeast, which Brian Pop Robson ran, and I'd go to various clubs. I just loved going around to different clubs, and myself and dad decided I wasn't going to sign for only at 13 when everyone else. He turned 13, you signed for a club.
Yeah.
So I didn't just sort of get the best training from everywhere possible.
Yeah.
But I was always I was just literally just waiting for someone to ask me to sign for them. As soon as they did, I did.
So you're on the bench, and does Peter Reid give you the shout then? What's the emotion as you get the shout?
At the time, I think it was because I was so devastated about not starting the game, because I kind of assumed because, well, there was nobody else. Lionel had gone home and thought, oh, well, at least I'll have this. And like I said, Liverpool put a full side out. And I think the first thing that I did when I came on the pitch, and the first thing I did was they've had a free kick and they've pumped it in the box. And I didn't have, because there was no consequence to it, there was no nervousness, there was no fear. I just came sort of edge of the box and just took it above Robbie Fowler's head. And it was like that, up to that point, that was the greatest moment in my life, bar none. And sort of like, and it was kind of like, then you hear all like sort of the applause in the background and that, and then it's just from then on sort of like, it's kind of a cliche with keepers in the game. So if you come and take across very early in the game, you know, that sets you up for it. And it was exactly how it happened. And then had a couple of close shaves, and then I remember, I think Michael Thomas might have still been there at the time. I think it might have been Michael Thomas. So we just cut the ball back sort of to the penalty area, and sort of John Barnes stood there by himself, drew the ball back. And I've kind of just come out just to sort of try and make myself big and just to react to it. And he's just smashed the ball, and it's went between my legs, and as I'm falling backwards, it hit me on the backside and hit the floor and bounced over the bar. And it's like, it's probably the luckiest and best save I've probably made to this point, you know. But it's like it couldn't have went any better for me.
Be honest and realistic, during your cross, your career in Aberdeen and Denmark, how many times have you gone back and had a think about those two saves or those two things? How often has that game come up in your conscious about the best part of football?
I think most of the time, when you're, especially as a goalkeeper, you're a natural analyst, because during the game you get an opportunity to think about what you've done. As a centre midfielder, you're always in action, you've always got to think about what's happening in the game, you're always involved. Whereas if something happens in the game as a goalkeeper, you can sort of go back to it and just think, well, what I could have done better, or should have been here, should have been there. So a lot of the time you often dwell, well, I often found that I dwell on the negative parts, simply because not just I didn't see it negatively. I just wanted to say, well, I wanted to do something better. I was going to improve it, like, you know. But so I could probably tell you off the top of my head 10 big errors that I made, but I probably struggle to tell you half of brilliant saves that I made.
I mean, that's the goalkeeper's lot, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So when I think of good positive things, and those probably were that they're the first saves that I was. Think of, I'd made hundreds and thousands before that. I'd probably made hundreds and thousands afterwards, but then it's the one that stick just because of the occasion as well.
Yeah. I was going to say that when you came and claimed that catch, what can you, again, you know, 20 years later, can you isolate those feelings and say, what, you know, how, when you heard the roar behind your ears, and how did you feel at the time?
I think as a not just a footballer but as an athlete, it's, you know, people talk about getting in the zone, and you want it. I've read a lot about especially sprinters sort of making a routine during the course of the day and the lead up to a race, so that not only that your body's prepared for it, but your mind's prepared for it. So that routine sort of sets you up, and if you do the same thing all the time, that you should arrive at that the same state of mind as well. It's not that easy to achieve, but I think in that one case it was just a case of sort of not even thinking about things and having the pressure taken off me and just coming and taking it, and it feels like the most natural thing in the world, where you know you've got nothing, you're not thinking about it at all.
It's almost like you're thinking, why can't you do that every single time?
Yeah, well, you know, I thought that more times than I was in the zone and all that, but from an early age I kind of stopped enjoying football from an early age. A lot of the time it was because I put a lot of pressure on myself, and anything positive and any sort of any great wins, it's more a feeling of relief than enjoyment of any kind. So it was that's probably why I associate so little good times than I do with bad times. And it's simply because, like I said, it's not a great feeling, it was just a relief.
Yeah.
And but at the end of that game, there was a lot of emotion afterwards. At the time, because sometimes because of nerves and sort of the adrenaline, you don't really enjoy it, or you don't sort of, it passes by very quickly, you don't get a lot of chance to sort of enjoy it. But then afterwards, we did a lap of honour around the pitch, and despite what happened on just getting relegated, the fans were unbelievable, and you know, so not necessarily see me dad up in the stand, and I kind of got to think, I got halfway around the pitch and I just it just literally all got too much for me, and I'd been disappointed by the fact that I was leaving the club and that I was having a sort of like the dream was over, or that dream was over anyway. But it wasn't until after the game I got halfway around, and then just it just started kicking in then, the reality of it all, it was sort of kicking in.
And do you think that was that night and that season particularly was the birth of what the modern Sunderland that, you know, I know the club's not in a great place now, but you think about the Keane era, you think sort of the end of the Reid era, the Keane era, where, you know, you played some pretty fantastic stuff and get back up. Was that night, do you think, the start of that move forward?
It was probably the year before, because I think I've said this before, that the not just Peter Reid arriving at the club, but the first first season of the Premier League, when Niall Quinn and Tony Courton came, it changed the whole dynamic of the change room. The fact that, and Paul Stewart as well, he came from, I think he came from Liverpool, and it was the fact that, you know, we'd had good players in there before, but it was very much a sort of championship mentality.
Yeah.
And very honest players, and you know, it's all about working hard, but then you had these players now who come in and expected standards, and who'd been at a certain standard and expect other people to be there around them. Paul Bracewell was instrumental when he came back to the club as well. Mm-hmm. And that's when the whole, you could see it just in an instant, the whole mentality of the change room changed.
And just the final thing on your memory then is that, you know, you're David Priest, I think 40, 41. When you stand on a football pitch still, do you still imagine yourself as a 17-year-old playing for Sunderland?
Do you know what? If I've got anything to be proud of in my career, is the fact that, one, I managed to make a career anyway and last till I was 35, 36. And I think one of the biggest reasons for that is because I never stopped thinking like that. I never stopped thinking that, like that 17, 18-year-old who just wanted to get better all the time and improve and to become a footballer. And I still, to be honest with you, even in my mid-30s, it was because I thought I'd never made it, because I never got to where I wanted to be, that I always held the hope that something better was going to come along. I mean, in the last 3 years that I had at Barnsley, that's where I'd, apart from the dream of, you know, like playing for England, winning FA Cups, being the captain and all that, you know, all the Roy the Rover stuff, the fact that that's where I'd wanted to be. So it was, I kind of proud of myself for keep going as long as I did to get, at least get to the championship level. And it just as a sort of bit of an irony, that's Lee Howie, you know, he was, obviously it was an accident and he broke my arm, but it wasn't until I actually saw him, we were standing sort of by the dugouts, that actually just he just clocked me and just could see that I was looking upset, and as soon as he just sort of like looked at me and came over and said, "Come here, big man," and he called me big man, he's probably about 2 or 3 inches bigger than me, and he just sort of like just cuddled me and just put his arm around me, cuddled me into his chest, and I just lost it, absolutely lost it. So I'd like to thank Lee Howie for making a fool of me, bubbling, bawling my eyes out in front of 20,000 fans.
So what moment have you plumbed for?
Well, the thing is, I've always been the same about football. I always get very emotional. It doesn't matter whether I've got any ties to the club, or whether it's Sunderland or whether it's England or whatever like that. It's something like, you know, United beaten Bayern Munich in 1999. It's literally something like that happened, and then watching the celebration after, it's really overwhelming for me. I don't mind saying I do sort of like get pretty teary pretty easily about these things, or get emotional over it, you know, because you kind of put yourself in their place or the place of the fans. It's, you know, you can empathise a lot with them. But so there could be that many moments that I can think of, and I've racked my brains about it. But the one thing that's the one moment that I can I can pinpoint and say that's had probably the biggest effect on me and as the way that I look at football. It was probably the day that I got it was my 10th birthday or just after or just a Christmas after my 10th birthday. I got given a Hero, and it was the video for the official video for the Mexico 86 World Cup.
Fantastic.
So and to be honest with you, I can't really remember a lot about that World Cup sort of at the time. Simply because I remember the hand of God and the England games, but much else from that, I didn't really take much notice. It wasn't until I got the video, and then over the course of the next few years, watching it dozens and dozens of times, sort of kind of fell in love with sort of the French team at the time, and the way that the video was, you know, you look listen now. I mean, I can't remember who did the score for it.
It doesn't ring a bell to me, but I'm sure
it's kind of like sort of like synth, sort of dramatic synth. It might have been Rick Wakeman,
possibly. We can always check and come in and tell at the end.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that was the thing about those World Cup films, though, weren't they? They used to slow it down because it was always from an angle that you would never see in a real game, wouldn't it? And it was a different.
A lot of it was pitch side or from right behind the goal, yeah, as well. So it was like when you see when Maradona against Belgium, when he goes past the down the left hand side, he just drifts past about three Belgian players, but you can see the angle from behind, just behind the goal there, that byline. You can see him face on coming towards it. It's just, you can see all like the slow down. There's all these desperate bodies throwing themselves in front of him. And he's just hurdling them all. It was brilliant. And I said it gave me sort of a taste of something that you didn't get at the time. The only time you got it was watching Transworld Sports for an hour on a Saturday morning before you went out playing football yourself. And yeah, it's not the same as today, where you see everything that goes on in every corner of the world. And it was just watching players like Francesco Lee for Uruguay, Michael Laudrup with Denmark. It started a kind of love affair that sort of culminated in around 2006. 2005, 2006, when I went over to play in Denmark, and Michael Laudrup was manager of Bromby at the time.
Brilliant.
Just kind of surreal situation. Just, I think it was quite early on when I first went there, and sort of coming out of the dressing room to go and do the warm up, and there's Michael Laudrup just standing, sort of writing something down in the corridor outside, waiting to go. I think he was waiting to see the referee or something. He was waiting for somebody, and kind of just walking past. And then, at the time, I was probably just turned 30, I think it was. Yeah, and sort of like, kind of like the little boy inside was just like sort of really fanboy and sort of like fawning over him, and then sort of like trying to keep me composed, just walk past and shake his hand and say hello, and then just walk on as if it's just a natural thing. And that was the thing. I never lost that throughout my career. And maybe sometimes it might have been to my detriment playing against bigger players, where you sort of you put them on a pedestal and you're still like young kids, so you're playing. I mean, I remember I played with and against Chris Waddle when he was at Sunderland, and then he went to Torquay afterwards, playing as Peter Beasley, who was Hartlepool. You know, and at the time, you never ever put yourself, even though you're both, when you're on that pitch, you're at the same level, yeah, but you still sort of like, you just feel as if you kind of feel smaller than, like, you know, in stature. You know, if you're looking at them and you just see them, they're just these huge footballing figures. So it was the same with Laudrup, and then it's mad. Then another 6 months later, we played them on a neutral pitch, played Bromby on a neutral pitch because our pitch was frozen. It was early on the it's sort of March, and we ended up beating 2-0. It was like I've just sort of just beaten one of my heroes, like, you know. It was.
And so going back to that video, was sparked off all these pinch me moments. And is that, I'm not a massive fan of this phrase, you know, football started before 1992. Yeah, we know it did, but things do evolve. But it is, these videos are almost the way that we progress the game, by getting people to remember just how good football is in the right way. You know, it's you were talking about Bayern Munich at the start, it's Ferguson's quote, isn't it? Football, bloody hell. Mm. And that, those videos, that those visions, those scenes, they lend to that.
It has so much of an effect on me that, like, with the French side, that's kind of, I hadn't watched much of them, but I was probably about 8, 9 years old when they won in 84, the Euro Championships in 84. And then in 86, sort of saw a little bit in the World Cup, watched the video. So then from that moment on, I sort of triggered something, right, that I want to play in France now. I want to, for some reason, I had Saint-Étienne and no idea, it was Strasbourg as well. I got this thing made, I want to go and play for them. I want to play in France. And that was one of the big, I never ever thought saw myself playing in Denmark, obviously. It's not like sort of, it would turn out to be one of the best things I ever did. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, I think that's not the dream you want. But it was because of that dream that I wanted to go to France. I'd never gotten the opportunity. And that's the fact that I missed out on that. I thought, well, bugger it, I'll go to Denmark and I'll try something different. And at least I'll say I've played abroad then. And so even that, and then you've got Peter Shilton's All Silver Strip. That Christmas, that's what I got for Christmas. I got this video and this All Silver Strip. And I've still got a picture of myself in the back garden, stood there with a pair of goalkeeping gloves on, a pair of Puma boots, like Shilton had as well.
Yeah.
And to this day, it's probably, I think, still the best strip I've ever had. So all these little things, it's accumulation of things that have just spawned from this video.
And you got to wonder how many people of 6 to 11 for the next year all played with a bandage on their wrist because it's what Gary Lineker had on.
Exactly, you know, and it was even going so far as when they started to do the section about following Argentina, so sort of they weaved it way through the groups, focusing on certain teams. So then when they picked up the thread of Argentina, and then I think it might be the first shot of him, I'm not sure, but it might be the first shot of him, and you see him, it's before a game, he's warming up and he's doing this hamstring exercise, so he's bent over and sort of bouncing and touching the ground behind him. I still did that stretch when I was well into my 30s, and that became part of my warm up. And even though it was like it probably went against what you were taught at the time, that you were supposed to like hold stretches for 15, 20 seconds and you weren't supposed to bounce, and it was going against all sort of like the physio's recommendations. I still did it.
Yeah.
Simply because he did it.
Yeah, if it's good enough for Maradona, it's good
enough. Yeah, but so I started doing it as a kid and sort of thinking, well, that looks great. I'd have no idea what the purpose of it was, but I started doing it and I kept doing it all the way through my career.
Did you have many hamstring problems?
No, I didn't, about 33 is first time pulled hamstring, so it was kind of doing that bad.
I think Mexico 86 was the first World Cup I remember, and then obviously Italia 90 was considered to be such a huge tournament. Are they, do you think they're World Cups that now people set? I mean, Brazil 2014 was tremendous as well, but are they the World Cups that people set their standards by?
I don't know. Maybe I don't know. It's just a nostalgia thing that I probably couldn't tell you half of what went on in 2002 or in Germany or South Africa. Nothing really stood out, but maybe that's just because it was, I didn't have that much focus on it. And the fact that this was the very first one where I really had an influence, where I took a great interest in the football, and everything was just all new to me, so it just all stuck, like, you know.
When was the last time you think you watched the video, and was there a go-to scene that you always loved watching?
I mean, obviously since YouTube came around, it's been on YouTube. There was two things that I looked for quite early on in YouTube and waited for them to be uploaded. One was Hero, and the other one was, it used to have a collection of, it was all the goals from Serie A, and it was like kind of, it must have been around 88, 89. And yeah.
We grew up with that video. That's why I knew that Ancelotti was a great goal scorer in midfielder.
Aldo Serena, Ramon Diaz. From much of those videos, I don't think I've ever seen or heard anything about Ramon Diaz. But all I hear is, I can still recall like the commentator shouting his name, like curling his R, or rolling his R, sorry, as he says Ramon Diaz. And like I said, it's the same with those videos. And then I think that the Football League brought out like sort of saves of the season, so they go through all the months of the saves of the season, and like said, Barry Horn, like making, you know, save of the month for November in 1989 for Millwall. So I just, all these little things stick, and it's, And I think there's such an overload of sort of information and sort of different football leagues, and you can have hundreds, you know, on a Saturday and see hundreds of goals. But then you hardly saw anything. So it's when you saw it, it stuck.
And so but as you say, so you go to and you look at it, and you remember. I mean, one of the things to remember about 86 as well was the kits. There was some outstanding kits that time, and that it's, you know, people say, oh, I don't care about a kit, but you remember that it was the first kit that actually took the players' bodies into consideration, things like that. And it was one of those standout ones. And so, could you pinpoint one thing that you go and look at if you go on YouTube, or just for anyone that's listening, do you want to look at particular things?
For that video, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's quite funny. We were talking about Escape the Victory early on, and it's quite funny how someone like Michael Caine can have such an involvement in the way you think about football, or when you think about memories, because obviously he was in Escape the Victory as well, and also he narrated this the hero as well. So, and it all starts when they'd had I think it was maybe the six or 8 months before the tournament, there was a massive earthquake in Mexico City, and it starts with all that, and it starts off very serious, and so there's a lot of, so it's quite heavy stuff to start with, though. But it's mad that, you know, you think of football back then, some of your best memories, then you think of Michael Caine as well.
But the last thing to sort of say on it really, isn't it, is that I mean, you can have over stylized production values and stuff like that, but football is the German saying, isn't it, the ball is round, anything can happen, it's an unwritten script, and that's why it lends itself to that dramatic value, isn't it?
Well, that's it. We talk about recent tournaments not being as memorable, but like, you're right, it's all, everything that happened in that tournament, it was kind of like I can't, off the top of my head, I can't remember, but how sort of
unbelievable. Yeah, we're
Yeah, we talk about recent World Cups and tournaments not being as memorable. I mean, you know, the last one's probably, except for people like Wales and Iceland, the rest of it's probably just forgettable for most other people. Like, you know, obviously Portugal remembered, but it was the fact that they didn't need any sort of, there's no editing, there was nothing needed. The football was a story. You know, you've got like Denmark beats Uruguay 6-0 or something, and then they get beat off Spain 5-0, and it's a cliche, you could write the script, obviously people could write the script, they write very good scripts for films that are unbelievable, you know, but for that tournament, all the little intricate stories around it and the way it did sort of naturally weave from one to the other, it was just beautiful stuff.